But where are you really from?
But where are you really from?
Hello, everyone. My name is Jesse Lynn.
And I'm Angela Lynn. Welcome back to another episode of But Where Are You Really From? Today, we're talking about digital nomad / remote work and what we speculate the future of all of that is, since it became more of a potential reality for a lot more folks since COVID kind of shook the entire world and the way that a lot of people work. So I thought we'd start out this topic by kind of recapping my own personal digital nomad experience, just in like a nutshell of like what my life's been like because COVID kind of like turned the world upside down. So I have been like officially homeless in like the most crude way, homeless since like Memorial Day of 2021.
It feels like it's been longer, but
no, because we were trapped in our apartment for a year and shutdown was March 2020 for most people, right? And our lease was up a year after that point. Okay. Like we renewed for a year. So May of 2021 is when we like officially left San Francisco. And then we had just been hopping from like Airbnb to Airbnb from that point. Although countries were not open yet, like most international travel was not a possibility at that point. So we were domestic digital nomads for like the first year until Korea, like this past spring, where we spent the last 3 months. So yeah, it's been interesting kind of like living out of a suitcase and like working from cafes and Airbnbs and yeah, I don't know. There's good and bad, I think, but it's cool that you do have this like flexibility to choose if you want to like just plant yourself in one place or yeah, if you want to go other places. So that's been cool. That was me. But yes, let's speculate on the future. The realities of a lot of like the way things have changed is that a lot of countries, well, a lot of places, like governmental bodies, whether it be like country level or like city level, county level, have been making bids to attract these digital nomad, like remote worker mm-hmm. folk, because especially places that are not necessarily like the hottest destination for like longer term folks, they realize like, hey, if we can like incentivize people to move here at least for a year up to like multiple years, they'll spend money in our economy and like help bolster that. So there have been so many countries that have been like coming out with quote unquote digital nomad visas. And what I find interesting is that most of these, because we both looked this up ahead of time, there's like a pretty long list of countries that are offering these kinds of things, but most of them are like minimum 1 year visas, which is like really generous for like very minimal requirements for a lot of these places.
I even saw domestically there were like a lot of cities and counties that were doing promotions about like, you know, move here and like we'll pay for your relocation costs, and there's like this program for people who move here using this program where like we take you on trips and like see the best of the local sites. So yeah, I feel like a lot of, not even internationally but even just locally, a lot of different places try to like grab onto that and like grab hold of that because they already saw so many people were like moving out and were open to moving out to like what we would previously call podunk places. They're like, oh yeah, people want to come here, all right cool, like we'll give you a little bit of incentive so that you'll pick our podunk place versus like wherever podunk place you were going to go to begin with, which I think is like really, really interesting form of like drawing people to work there that hasn't existed domestically before. I feel like internationally, maybe like something like that has existed in some form for some of those countries already on the list, like drawing workers out there. But yeah, domestically, I don't think I've ever seen that before.
I definitely saw at least two or three different domestic campaigns for like rando cities I would have never considered.
West Virginia. I got one for West Virginia. I was like, I'm not moving there.
I think I also got one for like in Kansas or like Kentucky or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, interesting. Mm-hmm. And we like vaguely considered it for a little bit because we were like, I mean, when we were domestic digital nomads for a while, I was like, if they're going to pay us and we don't need to be anywhere, we just, it didn't end up happening. But yeah, it is cool. I think there are like slightly different reasons why domestic versus international are offering the incentives though, or what is interesting for the remote workers for either of those cases. Because domestically, like they're hoping you like live there and like just like essentially like move out of these like very dense few cities that most of us live in and like spread out and help again like jolt the economy so then like housing prices go up, everything becomes better, blah blah blah. But the international ones, I saw there's kind of like two different waves of like programs that they're running. So the country level, I think it's largely like take advantage of our like lower cost of living compared to wherever you are from and spend your money here, at least for a year. That's kind of like most of the country level stuff. But then I did see similar things for like rural cities within European countries. And it's places where their like fertility rates are so low that it's like, you have to move here for 10 plus years and we'll pay you per family or per person per and we'll pay you more money per baby.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's like literally like we have 100 people in our town. We need you to like repopulate our town. So it's kind of interesting to see like all these different, like I said, like governmental bodies, right? Because it's like from country level down to like city level, all trying to like vie for this group of new like potential people that they can draw in.
It's so interesting because I'm curious as to whether these incentives will continue and actually change in the form of labor competition. Because for a while, before the Fed started pumping the brakes on the economy and like people were like blah, 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 I felt like it was... The talk track was that it's a hiring bonanza. There's a dearth of talent. Like, you can't find people to fill the role, even though you have the role open. So I'm curious, like, coming out of this, assuming that there is no crazy recessionary situation, or even if there is, like, coming out of that, whether or not there will still be, like, global competition for talent. Our company was hiring, like, really crazy, and for a while they were, like, not saying it, but they were, like, we want to hire as many people as possible. Try not to hire anyone that's, like, shitty. No, it wasn't like that. It was basically, like, we want to hire as quickly as possible, but, like, please make sure that you're still submitting people who are, like, qualified for the position. Like, we really, really want them as opposed to, like, they can just do the job and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I noticed at the end of my time at Ubisoft that because we had multiple locations of offices, and North Carolina is another like big hub for their domestic stuff, and it's obviously a lot cheaper to live in North Carolina than it is in San Francisco. So there were definitely a lot more North Carolina hires because they as a company essentially were like, why would we hire more expensive San Francisco peeps when we can hire cheaper North Carolina peeps? So let's name drop a few countries in case people are interested.
Let's look at the list, baby.
Yeah, there's honestly
so many lot
of countries. Yeah. The first one that like stuck out to me because it was actually one that we considered when we were still kind of like plotting out where we might go is Portugal, because they made a pretty big splash during like the initial digital nomad phase, because they announced that like you could not only get the 1 year digital nomad visa like very easily, but then if you wanted to stay longer, it could very easily transition into a permanent residency visa and then eventually like legitimate permanent residency. So I originally thought about it because I was like, that might even be easier for me to become like an EU citizen eventually than through marriage, just because of all the like red tape around like getting citizenship. So yeah, Portugal definitely is like very high up there for like super remote worker friendly and like pretty relatively easy steps.
That's what my friend did. She and her husband moved to Portugal at the time with their newborn, and I think they have another baby now. So, and that baby was, I believe, born there. Yeah. So,
that's nice. Yeah.
I think they're making it. I think they're staying for the long haul, kind of like what
you
said.
That's pretty dope.
Yeah, it is pretty dope.
I noticed that most of the lists, though, a lot of them are like, you know, islandy type places, like Bali or like Barbados and Grand Cayman and stuff, which is like, for me, thinking about those places as like for additional nomad life, I personally wouldn't want to stay there for that long. Like, it's nice if I wanted to go for like a few weeks, but I think those places get a little boring after like too many days in the sun. Yeah. And by the beach, I'm just like, what else is there to do? So for me, I'm like, a year or more? I don't know. I don't know if I could do that.
I mean, the rankings, I feel like for the most part, never taking into account, like, are you going to have fun here? It's kind of just like, does the infrastructure support it? Like, or do you actually have like streaming high-speed internet? Is there like a government that doesn't suck? Like, is there like turmoil in the economy? And then that's like kind of it, where it's like you can work, you can be safe, and there's not like a huge unrest in the country. But I don't know if they take into account like quality of life, things like that.
I don't think so in these rankings. There were a few that stood out to me because I didn't know that they had these kinds of visas. So like technically Spain has one of these. Yeah. Which I was like, oh, okay. And Taiwan has one. It's you can stay for up to like three to five years, something like that. But it's mostly for richer folks. It's like an investor type.
Oh, I see.
Investor entrepreneur type one. And there are like different types when it gets to that kind of level, because I noticed some of the ones that were like surprising to me, I was like, oh, I don't know if I would count this as like remote worker, digital nomad, because for example, like Switzerland has it, but I saw that their minimum salary requirement was like really high. I was like, I don't know that like most people could prove like this amount of salary, but I guess it's very expensive to live in Switzerland. Yeah, so they just want to make sure you're not like homeless.
Yeah,
that makes and then sense. Taking their tax dollars to
honestly live. Some of these programs I've probably been around for a while, and like they probably like most people don't even know that they exist. I remember at the last company I worked at, when I onboarded, there was a Canadian guy that was joining at the same time, but he was going to be working in the Polish office. I worked at a Polish company previously, and I was like, how are you working here? Like, I didn't think it was that easy to just be able to like land in Poland and work. And he was like, oh yeah, like the Canadian government and like Polish government have this like exchange work visa program that's like very, very like hidden. He was like, I found it, but it took me a while to apply because no one actually knew what the program was. It's like probably something that people don't use very frequently, and probably wasn't super popular until people were like, oh fuck, I don't want to be like stuck here in my country when things are nicer in this country and it's cheaper and you have the same quality of living, la 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 la.
Related to that, let's get into pros and cons for remote workers to live abroad. I know we talked about their domestic incentives too, mm-hmm. but I think the like most commonly talked about is people that are moving abroad. So obvious pros, because we're coming from the US, almost everywhere has a lower cost of living than we do. Even places like at most European countries, barring places like Switzerland, which is like kind of mm-hmm. crazy. But like, for example, we lived in Japan for a little bit and Korea just recently. We're going back to Japan soon. And those are places that like, or at least Japan is a place that people commonly think is like very expensive. But actually when you live there, like once you get past the cost of flying there, it's very cheap to live as long as you're not going to like crazy fancy places every night. So you save a lot of money literally just on like rent, for example. Like even Airbnbs, there's a premium added to whatever the locals are paying, but it's a lot cheaper than, for example, like San Francisco or New York rent prices. And like eating and just like everyday costs, a lot lower. The other main incentive, obviously, getting to travel and see Absolutely. The world, see different yeah. things, have that flexibility, learn a new culture, like try different things, meet new people. I don't know, all the like main things that come with travel, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's all of those things. And for me, I think it helps you in your professional pursuits to have a wider experience in terms of interacting with other people, understanding different work styles. Because, I mean, for me, I've had to work with a lot of people from around the world, and I'm sure it would be very helpful to actually be there with that person to really understand, like, their workday looks like this, their challenges look like this, their incentives look like this, and that would make that kind of cooperation, like, a lot easier. So that's definitely, like, I think personally a professional pro as well.
And learning that culturally there are different reasons why people mm-hmm. work differently in those offices, not just because you're, like, on video versus in person. It's, like, literally, for example, like, I would never have known really how the Japanese work culture was until I sat in that office and, like, interacted with them every day.
I'm curious, would you say that, generally speaking, the work culture outside of the U.S. is more easy, more relaxed, or less relaxed?
I don't think you can really answer that question in such a general term, because it totally depends on which country, and it depends on what kind of company. Like, if it's, like, a very traditional conservative one, or, like, a more progressive tech, you know, startup-y type thing. Because, for example, like, I was working at a tech company when I went to Japan for the 2 months I lived there previously. And I would say the office was still a little stuffy, like a still kind of, you know, like, more rigid than I would have expected for a tech company, especially coming from, like, literally, like, the same company, but in the Bay Area, where it's, like, very chill and whatevs. But one day I, like, got off on the wrong floor and I was, like, wandering around, and it was some, like, gasoline company, like one of the, like, major, for example, if it was like ExxonMobil or whatever, but like their corporate offices. And I walked around, I was like, where am I? Like, it was so stuffy. It was like, oh, you could hear a pin drop. Like, everybody was wearing, like, suits and, like, just, like, deadpan and, like, very focused. And I was like, oh, let me find where I'm supposed to go, because this is not it. So I still think there's, like, variance. But, for example, like, I don't know that you could say the same thing about, like, Spain or whatever. Like, I don't think everyone has the same, every country has, like, much more stringent or much more relaxed than the U.S. Hey listeners, wondering how you can support us? The biggest way is by increasing our visibility by following us on Instagram at Where Are You From Pod, on TikTok at But Where Are You Really From, subscribing to our YouTube channel under But Where Are You Really From Podcast, rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, and telling your friends. The more people we can get to listen to the show, the more we can continue spotlighting different perspectives and stories. And if you feel so inclined, we're also accepting donations at buymeacoffee.com/whereareyoufrom. Thanks, y'all. Well, we said pros.
Yeah.
Cons, I can speak for myself. Two main cons: unless you're in an English-speaking country, or you are descendant of whatever culture you are have immersed into, language is probably a barrier for you for some of these places. Like, I would say a lot of the countries on the list have, like, try to tout, like, English friendly, but, like, that's probably in pockets, you know? It's, like, the places that are, like, really trying to attract this money. But not having English be, like, super easily accessible to you is going to be a reality you have to face. So either you have to, like, just be okay with kind of, like, having misunderstandings all the time, like, stumbling your way through, or you need to start learning the local language, at least bare minimum stuff, so that you can, like, skate by a little bit better. And then related to that, I think it's fairly easy to have a little bit of a, like, identity crisis or, like, anxiety kind of around not being able to fully express yourself because you don't speak the language. And depending on if you're there to, like, try to make friends or anything, like, if you can't speak with most people, like, that's gonna be really difficult unless you go to places where there are lots of expats, or, like, there are local folks that are, like, interested and able to speak with people that only speak English. So that's just a reality. It's, like, you might find that there is a bit of, like, loneliness attached with it because you cannot fully, like, communicate.
Well, associated with that, I think probably there's definitely some like homesickness, missing your friends, missing your family associated with traveling, because I'm sure it's just not as easy to keep in contact with everybody or like make a phone call whenever you want, given the time difference.
Lots of avenues for homesickness, right? Like you're never going to find like every single type of food that you're used to eating or like products that you're obsessed with. That like my suitcase was filled with like specific, you know, like toiletries that I was like, I know I'm not going to be able to get this in Asia. It's just like, you're just going to like get used to not having that kind of stuff.
I remember, so this is not really a work abroad situation, but I remember when I studied abroad in Spain, and I probably have told you this story, but one of my friends, actually the one that's in Portugal now, she's Indian, and there's no spices in the food there, and there's no sriracha stocked in the store there. So like we literally spent an entire day just looking for spicy food, and finally she found sriracha at a like a Asian restaurant and just ordered like a bowl of rice and poured like sriracha in it. It was so funny.
You did
like,
tell me that.
It's crazy the things that like you miss when you like live abroad for an extended period of time. But actually, I wanted to ask, I also assume that working abroad, the tax situation becomes more complicated.
Yeah, it is more complicated. I think going back to pros and cons, a pro is that usually when you're on these like digital nomad visas, you don't owe taxes to the country that you are in.
Okay, work.
But speaking as an American, you still owe taxes to the country that you are from. That is not the case for every country. Like Spain doesn't collect taxes from Ramon when he's not in Spain, but the U.S. gonna money grab you until you're dead. So it is more complicated. There's like a potential for you to get at least part of your taxes like prorated, where you don't necessarily owe like all of the year if you've spent over, I think, over 180 days outside of the country. So there are some like technicalities, but like your domestic U.S. taxes do get a little bit more complicated when you live abroad. But most of these countries, you don't then owe them taxes. They just want your money that you spend there while you're there. I think it depends on what kind of visa you're on. Like, I think if it was like a business visa or something, it's different. Okay, next, pros and cons for the local people, because I don't think this is talked about enough when it comes to the subject. Main pro and why people, governments, keep drawing these digital nomads into their worlds is for the money to stimulate their economies. And that helps everyone technically who lives in that country, because you have more money to like go towards infrastructure and like whatever else the government needs money for. However, there are definitely cons to us type of people flooding into all these countries, namely that it gentrifies a lot of places that like otherwise would remain more culturally intact and like more affordable for the local people. Mm-hmm. So like whenever you think about us saying like it's so cost effective for us, it's like yeah, but you're raising the prices for local people, so then it becomes less cost effective for them because they already make less money than you do. I don't think the average Spaniard or like the average Korean or whatever is saying like food is so cheap. Like, they're just like, this is what food costs. But then, like, suddenly, if, like, remote workers, like, flood it and it's, like, doubles the cost, and it's like, wait, I can't afford this anymore, you know? So I think that's the main one, is, like, people are getting priced out, especially, like, housing and, like, real estate related, you know, commercial property and all that stuff. It's, like, not too great.
Yeah, I think it's also, good of you to point out before that many of those people don't pay taxes on their income in the country. So I think there's also, if not the reality, the perception that there are people here enjoying the goods and services paid for by the local taxpayers, but not contributing to that. And of course, it depends. Like if you are a high worth individual, you could be bringing like a lot of money in your spend in the area that could offset like the fact that you don't pay any taxes. But I think it really depends, and I think it could really chafe people to know that there are like tons of rich people moving here that don't have to pay any like income tax or anything like that. And I think a really great example of this, it was like very controversial, the whole like Amazon HQ2 thing in New York City. And it was kind of that vibe where it was like, well, you're gonna bring like a lot of rich workers here, but like everybody that lives here already is not really going to benefit from it because Amazon's getting all these tax breaks and like the local infrastructure wouldn't support it. Like there's only one train line that goes there. So there are just all of these like considerations about like bringing a huge workforce with high income to a small area that's like not prepared to support it. And I just think that it's a planning thing, kind of like it almost feels really sometimes short-sighted with some of the places where it's like, okay, cool, like short-term economic investment, great. What are we going to do with all these people in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? Like there's not really a thought about like what happens after that, which then really sucks for the people who are like, we want to live here in 15 years. Like, why aren't you thinking about like what our quality of life and like our living situation will be like? So I definitely feel like there's this like tension between like making things work economically short term versus like making things work economically long term for the people who are like residents of the area.
I definitely agree that it's largely a government issue, like government planning issue, as you pointed out, because I read a couple articles about Mexico City, because that's a very popular remote work destination, especially amongst Americans, which is like comical because it's like a reverse border situation. And Californians are like particularly the worst when it comes to like making up a huge swath of this population. Of course. I personally know several people that have spent like extended time.
So many gay people go down to Mexico, Puerto Vallarta, Ciudad de Mexico, like all those places. Yeah.
Yeah. Mexico City in particular, I think because its capital is attracting like a lot more folks that are trying to stay like longer than like a vacation stance, you know, trying to do remote work there. And it was interesting because kind of the opinions of like a lot of the local folks are like, they're angry because they're literally getting priced out. One guy said he was living in an apartment and like, because the government spent money to remodel or like redo, spruce up the local park or whatever near the apartment complex, it meant that it was going to become a quote unquote better area. So then the landlord evicted everybody so that they could turn their building into like a hotel or like tourist friendly thing, knowing that it was like the neighborhood was changing into this like more gentrified higher end place. And so he was like, yeah, you know, I couldn't live there anymore. And he and a couple others in this article were saying like they're angry at tourists because they're and these remote workers because they're obviously the reason why the government is and these like entrepreneurs are like investing in these more like foreigner focused things and taking away the local things. However, they're like, we logically know it's not like the tourists' fault. Like it's not like they did anything per se. It's just like there was no infrastructure in place to like curb the amount that this stuff is happening or like the rate with which it's happening. So they're like, yes, we're mostly actually angry at like the policies that are like enabling this to kind of like free for all, but we have no way to like really impact that. So we're just getting angry at these people. Like they're literally posting signs on the street saying like, go home, like we don't want you here.
Well, it's funny because there are cities that have been doing that. I remember, was it before the pandemic? It was like before the pandemic. Barcelona, the mayor of Barcelona was like, tourists, don't come, we don't want you. They're like, is there too many people here and there's too many like Airbnbs that people can no longer like affordably live in Barcelona, don't come. And I mean, I guess it makes sense because I think if you're, again, if you're thinking about balancing like short term and long term, like for me, I would say like you need to think about like how long this revenue stream from the tourism is going to come versus like a long term resident being there or a long term residence being there for an extended period of time and like continuously feeding into the local taxes. Like, I don't know, I feel like someone has crunched that or should have crunched that, but it very often feels like there is not. Because they don't, no one ever says anything about that. They never say like, oh yeah, and we have assessed that over a period of 10 to 15 years, like this will still be a viable revenue stream for us versus like, this is hot right now. And we know it's a hot revenue stream for us like right now, but like what will happen when people no longer, like for example, a lot of people are going back to the office, people will may no longer be able to remote work depending on the situation. So like what will happen to all of those areas that expanded into tourism for the excess demand when that demand disappears.
I definitely think that you're right that there's like a temporal element to the policy thinking around the remote work stuff in particular, because we were talking about like speculating, but like, yeah, we don't know for sure that like as big of a population of folks can maintain a remote work digital nomad lifestyle for the long run, because if they are dependent on like their companies making those decisions about return to office and whatever, I don't know, that could be cut in half or like more overnight. And then you're right, it's like, well, they flipped all these neighborhoods, what are they gonna do about it? I think there's another like side of that debate, which is not temporal, it's like just kind of a long-standing debate that like I don't think any governments have figured out, and it's what you were talking about with Barcelona as your example, because Kyoto is another phenomenal example of this, because as we have been like patiently waiting for Japan's borders to reopen, there are so many articles about Kyoto and the residents' opinions about tourists, because notoriously they've hated tourists because they've kind of like crushed the local culture and like just flooded the streets, because Kyoto is so popular because it has maintained those like traditional elements of like the shrines and like customs and the food and stuff. And so people go there to like experience traditional Japan, but then because they're flooding there, they're like making it not zen anymore. It's like so noisy and like really, you know, it's just like it's different. And so traditionally the last like several years, the local residents of Kyoto are like, get the fuck out, like we don't want you here, right? And then the pandemic happened and Japan has been, the barring China, that's like literally locking people up in their apartment complexes for weeks on end. Oh my God. Japan is one of the most closed countries left within the global like COVID policies. So like no tourists have been in for like 3 years essentially. And now the Kyoto residents are like, I still hate tourists, but we need them, man. We're fucking dying, because so many of their businesses are completely dependent on tourists, and that's from year over year of like building that up, not just like a seasonal thing like this Mexico City might be like a shorter term thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Kyoto, Barcelona, these like very popular type international cities, it's like no one seems to have figured that out, because there's this big tension between like we need them, we hate them, haven't figured out what the balance is.
And I mean, it's not like a theme park. There's no way to stop people really from coming. But I do think that as a tourist, it sucks, but certain policies that I've seen in place make sense. So like in Barcelona, I went back there, I think in summer of 21, and at Park Güell, they were enforcing basically like a ticket to enter the park. And then there was another ticketed line for like the most popular parts of it. So the like arches under near the fountains. I had been there and done that experience when it was like, you just had to like reserve a time. It was free. You just had to reserve a time. Now it's like double pay. You have to pay to get in, and then you have to pay to do the popular things, which sucks as a tourist. But on the other hand, like it kind of makes sense. Like if you want your cultural attractions to last for a long time, and you want your tourism to be sustainable, and you want the experience to be nice for everyone, you have to start like limiting who can have access to it, or like how many people can be there at one time. So yeah, it's interesting to think about like different places and how they're trying to like manage the influx of remote work and people who aren't like local residents.
Yeah, it's also like just tied to the larger topic of gentrification, which I don't really know how governments really like tackle that problem, because it just keeps happening. And it's like you said, you can't exactly stop it. There's like free market going on and stuff, but there's so many pros and cons to it, right? Like, because even in that Mexico City article, the guy who's complaining was like simultaneously saying like, I can't totally complain because these neighborhoods that used to be like really dangerous are now safer and like more pleasant for everyone to be in. So, and there's more art and like culture from these people coming in. So he's like, it's not all bad. It's just like our stuff is getting like bulldozed. Well, I think there's a lot to chew on there. We'll move on over to our fortune cookie closing section. Jesse, you would be interested in living abroad at some point.
Oh, certainly, yes.
But what's like the longest amount of time that you would consider living abroad and potentially being a digital nomad or maybe settling, but like being abroad?
It's honestly, it's so hard to say. And I really think it depends on if I can land there and find a good group of friends, like in the first year or so. Because I think that that really can, and I'm assuming in this situation that I am solo and not with a partner, but I just think that I wouldn't be able to tolerate a situation with no friends for like more than a year. I think that would be really challenging. But in terms of how long I would stay there, it really depends. Like, I didn't come to New York with a plan to stay all the time that I have. Like, it's just happened year after year after year that I'm like, there's nothing else calling out to me. Like, I don't feel compelled to go anywhere else. Like, I like being here. And I think that would be very much the same for me if I moved abroad. Like, if I moved abroad, found a good group of friends, like, really vibed somewhere, and I had no reason to leave, like, it's a better experience than I had in California or a better experience that I had in New York, like, I'll stay as long as I can stay. What about you?
I can't make those same calls.
You have different life plans.
Yeah, yeah, I can't pretend I'm not married, and I can't pretend like we're not gonna have kids in the future. So, no, I mean, our plans, because we literally have been doing and are doing the digital nomad life right now, our current plan is to continue with this life until like summer of next year, because I mean, our original plan was to live in Japan for like a year essentially, and we've had to keep pushing that because of their borders. So we want to go for hopefully 6 months. Obviously we'll have to like hop in and out to make the visa situations work, but next summer is probably like the last of it. And then I don't think we'll be like living abroad again until we're retired, probably. Because I don't think we would necessarily retire in the US. It's just like better.
But you're going to retire at like 45, right?
I mean, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. Well, basically, it's like after kids no longer need us at all, when can we swing it
Makes sense.
Yeah. How about you, listeners? Let us know in the comments. Mm-hmm. Would you want to be a digital nomad?
Are you
if
a digital
so,
nomad?
Are you a digital nomad? And if you are, where have you been? How long have you been one? If you aren't, where would you want to go? How long would you think you could stay abroad? Mentally, emotionally, financially? Let us know in the comments wherever you are watching this, and let us know what you thought about this episode, things we might have missed about pros and cons for both the remote workers and the local people, because I think we just kind of scratched the surface on this topic. Let us know what you think, and come back next week because we will have another fresh episode for you then. And until then, zaijian, bitches.